We're actually doing the talk now. Today we're going to talk about C Sharp 4.0. Now, since this is a C Sharp talk, I figured I'd start out with a little C Sharp story. I've been a consultant for a number of years, and definitely the most memorable engagement I've had to date was when I spent a couple of years at the largest ad-serving company in the world. And the mandate that my team and I were given at that time was to transition the ad-serving traffic from the company's existing ad server to the .NET platform. Now, the existing ad server that this company had was already the highest volume ad server in the world, and it served over 3 billion requests per day. So, just to give you a context how much volume that is, that's about an order of magnitude higher than the number of Google.com searches that happen in a single day. So, we're talking a lot of volume. It was written in C++, scaled out on about 450 Linux servers. So the process of transitioning all this to the Microsoft platform was a daunting one, to say the least. And we certainly had some naysayers, oh, you're never going to get .NET to do that. You're never going to get C Sharp to do that. And certainly we had a bunch of challenges throughout the project, which included situations where we truly had to understand the depths of the C Sharp language as much as possible. We were basically just writing C Sharp, just managed C Sharp. We weren't using a bunch of ASP.NET. We weren't using trickery like unmanaged code blocks in C Sharp. It was just the C Sharp language, managed C Sharp. But we had to understand the depths. We had certain algorithms that we need to implement efficiently or managing memory efficiently. It wasn't enough just to know the basics of C Sharp. We had to truly understand all the details of the language. A high-volume website like that, you think about, you know, you go to Yahoo and you see the banner ad across the screen that's making calls to the ad server. And all these high-volume websites, Yahoo, AOL, MSN, all of these high-volume sites are all making calls to this ad server. That's how the volume is so high, because it's essentially an aggregation of that volume. Well, when it was all said and done, we were successful at transitioning all this volume over to the .NET platform. And not only were we successful, but our numbers fared pretty well. For example, a single With the legacy system, which I mentioned before, had about 450 Linux server. A single server did about 350 requests per second. With our initial .NET system, a single box for us did about 1,700 requests per second, up from 350. So we didn't need 450 servers. We only needed about 100 to 150 servers. Now, there were certainly some mitigating circumstances around those numbers. For example, our architecture was truly a multi-threaded architecture, so we were able to take advantage of the latest and greatest hardware and multi-core processors. There were some reasons there. So, you know, I don't tell the story in any way to attempt to start a religious debate between C Sharp and C++ or Linux and Windows. That's not my intention for telling the story. The reason I tell the story is to illustrate that in the last few years, with the maturity of the .NET framework, Microsoft has now given us the tools to build the most robust enterprise-level system. And it's our responsibilities as developers to be able to learn those tools and learn the facilities that Microsoft has given us as best as we possibly can, so that when a situation comes up in our job, we can use the appropriate tool for the appropriate job. And that's why we're all here today, to learn those things. Now, as I go through some of the features that are new in C Sharp today, there may be some of you sitting there, and you might see a couple of features, and you say to yourself, that's a great feature and all, but that's not exactly going to be a life-changing feature for me as a C Sharp developer, maybe the way generics was when it was introduced in C Sharp 2. And that's fine. That's a fine reaction. That's true in some cases. Additionally, there may be some of you, if you've been coding C Sharp for a number of years, particularly when I start talking about the dynamic features that have been added to C Sharp, and your C Sharp statically typed minds, when you start seeing some of that stuff, you may see yourself, I don't know what I think about this dynamic stuff. This doesn't quite fit with my mental notion of my statically typed C-sharp language that I've come to know and love. And that reaction's fine, too, as long as it doesn't serve as an excuse for you to not learn dynamic. No, learn about dynamic. Learn how to use it. Learn how it's important. And with that knowledge, you can also learn when it's not appropriate to use it. Sometimes when we learn something, it can be just as important to know it so we know when not to use it as when to use it. So we're using it appropriately, not abusing the feature. People always abuse language features. So with that in mind, let's continue. A quick history of the C-sharp language. When .NET 1.0 and 1.1 came out, we had C-sharp 1.0. And right out of the gate, C-sharp was an incredibly full-featured, object-oriented language that enables to be productive very quickly. Then the .NET Framework 2.0 came out, and with it we had C-sharp Language 2.0, which came with about 10 to 12 new features, headlined, of course, by generics. And we also had several other features that came out in 2.0, like anonymous methods and partial classes and static classes and nullable types and a whole slew of features added in C-sharp 2. Then .NET Framework 3 came out, and we still were on C-sharp 2. There was no increment to the C-sharp language. With .NET 3, we had Windows Communication Foundation introduced, and Workflow Foundation, and Presentation Foundation. But we still have the same CLR, still same C-sharp language. Then .NET Framework 3.5 came out, along with Visual Studio 2008, and we got C-sharp 3.0. So, if you ever hear someone mention C-sharp 3.5, that's really a misnomer. It doesn't exist. It's .NET Language Framework 3.5 corresponds with C-sharp 3.0. And C-sharp 3.0 was headlined with Link, and 10 to 12 new features with C-sharp, which included many features that were there in direct support of Link, such as lambda expressions and extension methods and anonymous types and object initializers, and also a couple of language enhancements that didn't necessarily relate directly to Link, such as auto-implemented properties. Now with .NET 4, we have a new version of the framework being released next week. We also have a new version of C#, so those numbers are going to line up again, and the feature that gets the most press, so to speak, is the dynamic features that have now been added to C#. And there's three other features we're going to talk about as well. There's four features being added to C# 4. A little bit of a difference from the previous versions, which added a dozen new features. Four features for C# this time, and those are the features we're going to cover today. And we talk about static versus dynamic, just from a conceptual level, before I get into my host of demos. When you think of static languages like Java and C#, static languages inherently have a couple of benefits, such as they're typically more performant and they lead to better scalability. And because they're statically typed, we can have more intelligent tooling, like the Visual Studio experience we've come to know and love. But then when you compare that to dynamic languages like Python and Ruby, dynamic languages also have a number of advantages that's been quite compelling developers in the last few years. Dynamic programming allows for a simple programming model. It's almost a metaprogramming model. You're typically not dealing with compiled code. And when you look at the popularity of frameworks in the last few years, such as Ruby on Rails, you really have to take a look at those dynamic languages to see, well, why are those scenarios compelling? What are those things we can benefit from and use in our programming as well? The four features I'm going to cover today, you can kind of mentally organize this talk for yourselves in four chunks. The first thing I'm going to talk about is dynamic. Then I'm going to talk about named and optional parameters, COM interop features that have been added to C#, and lastly, I'm going to discuss variants. So when you leave here today, you should have a pretty good understanding of, I know what the new features of C# 4.0, it's these four features, and you're going to have a basic idea of, you know, how these features can benefit you in actual applications. So with that, we'll start with our first step, which is dynamic. And everything starts from the DLR, or Dynamic Language Runtime. This is now being introduced in .NET 4. The DLR sits on top of the CLR, the Common Language Runtime. And this is what, when we resolve methods or properties at runtime, the DLR is what is making that work in the background. The DLR is meant to unify all things dynamic. And you're going to hear me talk about that theme of unification a couple of times in this talk. If you think about Link, one of the goals of Link was to unify all things queryable. So whether you had a database or just a set of in-memory objects or a web service or an XML file, whatever the case may be, Link provided you a common API, a common programming experience, so that it unified working with all things queryable. Now, you might have some subtle differences of data context and length to SQL and how you get a handle to that thing that's queryable, but the ability to have query-like syntax, a similar syntax regardless of what you're working with, that was one of the main design goals of Link. And I think they accomplished that pretty well. As I go through some of the examples today, you're going to see me draw parallels in that regardless of the dynamic scenario we're talking about, whether it's interoperating with another language or dealing with a DOM like XML or even reflection, I don't have to memorize six different APIs to work with this versus that. It's going to give me a common API for all of these scenarios. And when we get into the demos, that'll crystallize a little better. a quick snapshot architecturally of what this all looks like. As I mentioned, the CLR sits on the bottom, and the dynamic language runtime sits on top of the CLR. The DLR primarily consists of three parts: expression trees, which you can think of as C-sharp expression trees we have in C-sharp 3.0, call site caching. The way to think of this is, let's say you're going through a loop 100 times, and the first time through a loop, you need to dynamically resolve a method. So it does that, it caches that, so the remaining 99 times through that loop, it can just use that result. It doesn't have to dynamically resolve the method 99 more times. Dynamic object interoperability. You think of binders. We have binders to various things, such as we have a binder to .NET. Think about it as reflection. Binder to Silverlight. Binder to JavaScript. Binder to Microsoft Office or to Iron Ruby. We have all these different binders, and once we get a handle of something, we can work with those objects. And sitting on top of all this, we have dynamic languages. So C-sharp and VB.NET now have dynamic features that have been added to them. In addition, we have languages like Iron Ruby and Iron Python that are now sitting in the .NET framework as full-fledged dynamic languages. We're going to talk about those as well. Now, before I actually get into the demos, you have to say to yourself, well, we're going to talk about syntax and compiler rules and all that, but let's also think about this in the context of practical applications. And some of these I'm going to show today, which is integrating with dynamic languages such as Ruby or JavaScript. Dealing with COM objects, if you're doing programming with Word or Excel, that's a scenario. How does your developer experience different now? Reflection is drastically simplified in DOM objects like XML. And I could have even put a bullet point on this slide saying, and more. Because a year from now, 2 years from now, who knows what other uses people are going to find that are very compelling, the dynamic programming experience. For example, when anonymous types were added to C-sharp 3, people said, you're only going to use those for link. They really don't have any value outside of link. And a few months later, you look at frameworks like MVC, and MVC was leveraging these anonymous types heavily throughout the framework to provide route values, and you see people using them for different things. So I'm going to show you some practical uses for dynamic programming today, but I just want to add that bullet point. Who knows what people will come up with? I'm sure people will find lots of ways to abuse it, and we'll hopefully throw those aside, but it'll also be interesting to see what compelling uses people come with it. So syntactically, before I crack open Visual Studio, what does this look like? What we have now introduced in C-sharp is a new keyword called dynamic. And what we do here in this declaration is we statically type something as dynamic. And that's kind of the joke inside Microsoft, that we're statically type something as dynamic. One way to think about it is this. C-sharp is a statically typed language, period. It always has been, and it is. So when we talk about adding dynamic features to it, we're just adding features, but it's still a statically typed language. So what we're doing here with this keyword is we're saying, hey, Mr. C-sharp compiler, I've declared this variable D as dynamic. So what that means is I'm instructing you, Mr. Compiler, ignore your typical static type checking rules to make sure this method exists or this property exists. Don't do that at compile time. Go ahead and resolve that stuff at runtime. And we can do that selectively. So in this method right here, getDynamicObject, it doesn't matter what that's returning. It could be a system.object, it could be a person.object. We don't care because we're not strongly typing it. We're statically typing it as dynamic. And at this point, that means we can call methods on it. If D had a method called M, fields and properties, indexers. Now, when you see the syntax here, what's interesting about it is this syntax is just C-sharp. It's interesting to hear Microsoft talk about some of the design iterations they went through when they were considering the different ways to implement dynamic. And they had some, we could use a syntax where you kind of dereference with a tilde and all this crazy stuff. And what they realized is all that was not going to be user-friendly to the developer. So they said, if we just introduce this keyword called dynamic and say, hey, relax the static type checking rules, we could just use normal C-sharp syntax. So when you heard me mention that dynamic is going to unify all things in a common syntax, sort of like LinkedIn, that common syntax is normal C-sharp syntax. Question?
What's the difference between that and a linked bind?
It is a late binding. Dynamic programming is at runtime, I will now dynamically resolve this method. Yep.
It's a new word.
Okay. Yeah. So with that, let's get into the first demo. I have to sit down. This is not exactly a podium. So I've got Visual Studio here. And the first thing I want to show is a reflection example. I'm going to unpin this. We have a little bit more horizontal real estate. So I have this method called getObject right here. And again, don't worry about what it returns. I'll show it to you in a second. But for now, I'm just using it as object. And I know that it has a property called name. And I know that it has a property called age. So I can dynamically resolve these things. If you think about it, C-sharp's always had dynamic capabilities. It's called reflection. We've had that since C-sharp 1. So I can run this, and I can get the property called name, and then get the value, and I can do the same thing for age. And it's fine. It works. I can see the name is Bob, and the age is 65. It works. Cool. But who wants to write code that looks like that? If anyone's ever worked with reflection code, I'm sure you've probably written code that looks almost exactly like this, and you can do it, and it works. But it's not necessarily fun to do. So how can we leverage dynamic programming to make this a little bit of a better developer experience now that we have C-sharp 4? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to make all this code downloadable from my blog within the next 24 hours, as well as the PowerPoint. So rather than deleting this code for the people that are going to download the code, I'm just going to lift it out of here. We'll call this the reflection example, so that you can recreate the demo. Anything I've done in the demo, you can recreate on your own. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to use this dynamic keyword. I'm going to still say foo, and I'm still going to call the same getObject method. But in this case, at this point, what I can do now is I can say foo. I'm going to write out to the console foo. Maybe put a little space in here. Dot name. And if you can see with IntelliSense, it's saying this is a dynamic expression. This operation will be resolved at runtime as I'm typing this name property. But I can just dot into it. I can just say foo dot name. And then I can just put a little space in here, and I can say foo.age. And I run it. It just works. I have Bob and 65, but I could use a natural C-sharp syntax where I could just say foo.name. I can just dot into it. That name property, I can just dot into it. Now, you might say to yourself, okay, but what if you made a typo? I didn't have IntelliSense there to tell me that I typed the name property correctly, and I didn't make a typo. And I didn't have the compiler telling me I didn't make a typo. So that's dangerous. Well, there's a caveat there. Yes, if you consider that statement in a vacuum, yes, that's true. But what's not the case is you have to remember, we were already in a dynamic scenario. We were already in a reflection scenario. So I already had a possibility of making a typo like that, name XXX. And I wouldn't have known about it from the compiler. I would have only known about it at runtime. So that's an important distinction to make. Microsoft is certainly not saying, go take all your statically typed resources, just convert everything to dynamic. No, no, no. That would be ridiculous. What Microsoft is saying, what you have to keep in mind as a developer, is if you are already in a scenario where you're doing dynamic programming like this, like I was here because I was having to use reflection code for whatever reason, then consider dynamic, the new dynamic features are added, making your life easier. I haven't introduced any more danger. In fact, I've introduced less, because look how much simpler my code is. And if your code is simpler, it's less prone to bugs. Now, the question is always, well, what if you do make a typo? Let's do that. Let's do name X. And I know that's a typo. We run it. We'll get a runtime error, of course, instead of a compile time error. Because it says, well, this object doesn't have a property called name X. So again, it would have been just like the reflection example if we had tried to call it. It's just that our programming paradigm is simpler. If anyone was curious, again, it doesn't matter. What this returned, I happen to use an anonymous type down there, but that was immaterial to the example. I could have used a person object. It wouldn't have made any difference. But just for those that are curious, that's what it looked like. So with a very simplest example, this is how you can incorporate the dynamic keyword. Now, let's go a step further here. Let's understand how this works under the covers a little bit. So I'm just going to say this is a dynamic example. Let's say I want to create my own dynamic object. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to go over. I'm going to create a new class called Simple Dynamic Object. And what you're going to see is I'm inheriting from a class called Dynamic Object, which is in the system dynamic namespace. And if we go have a look at it, what you're going to see is it implements the iDynamic MetaObject Provider interface. And this interface, if you want to go look at that, has one method called getMetaObject. This interface, iDynamic MetaObject Provider, this is the interface that makes all of dynamic programming possible in the .NET framework. Now, it's not trivial to implement this interface straight up. So what Microsoft does is they provide this nice little base class called DynamicObject to make it much easier for you as developers to implement your own dynamic objects when the situation arises. So that's what I'm doing here. I'm inheriting from DynamicObject. And what I'm doing is I'm overriding a couple of the methods, tryGetMember and trySetMember. And if we just look at what kind of methods you have in here, just to show it real quick, we have try delete member, delete index, get member, get index. You see the different overrides you have available in Dynamic Object. And all I'm doing is I have a private dictionary here, and I'm wrapping the dictionary with these methods. It's keyed by string and object, and I'm just doing the try get value of the dictionary class, and then I'm using the dictionary syntax to set values into the dictionary class. So let's see how we can use this. I'm going to use dynamic foo again. This time I'm going to say new simple dynamic object. And in this case, I can just arbitrarily add properties to it. So I can say foo.name equals Bob, and I can say foo.age is 21. And so I'm setting values in, and I can also get values out. Here's foo.name. And then I can say foo.age. And I can even check out the type as well, foo.age.getType. And I run it. There it is, Bob, 21. And we can even see that 21 is an int32. Let me run this one more time, but this time let me stick a breakpoint in, and so we can see the debugger when it runs. What you see is it hits each method, the input is the set member binder object, and binder.name is name the first time around. The second time around, binder.name is age. So I'm naming what I want this property to be called. I'm setting it into the dictionary, and the same thing coming out, it's name, age, that's the third time to get the type. Now, when you think about it, it's the same situation where I can make a typo, and you can get a runtime error. But I was using a dictionary. So if you're using a dictionary in your code, you have just as much opportunity, this dictionary is keyed by string, you have just as much opportunity in your code, and when you're specifying the key as a string, you put this string in double quotes, you can make a typo, and it's the same thing. It's just a little bit of a different syntax. The syntax here is just regular C-sharp syntax. So I'm arbitrarily adding properties to this object, and I can store values in them, and get values out of them. Now, I implement this simple dynamic object, so you can see how things really work behind the scenes and see some of these base classes and base interfaces. There's actually a class that comes with the .NET framework now, .NET Framework 4, that has similar functionality to what I just implemented, but additionally has the added distinction of having the coolest name of any class in the .NET framework. So same namespace, the system dynamic namespace, new expando object. And it does the same thing. I can arbitrarily add properties to and from that. It does the same thing. But I wanted to implement the simple dynamic object so you could actually see how that works behind the scenes, how you can implement some of these things yourself. Okay, I want to go show a few more examples here with dynamic. Questions before I show additional dynamic examples?
Any object in .NET can be, you can work with it.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, in my opinion, if I ever have to write reflection code again, I won't. I'll use dynamic. That's a good example of pointing out use. Yes, another question.
The congestion you think about, var and dynamic. Var is static, but that's the local variable. Can that var outreach its current scope now by passing it in and being able to receive it as dynamic possible or something like that?
Oh, didn't mean to kick. So the question was kind of contrasting the var keyword that was added in C-sharp 3 with the dynamic keyword. An important distinction is, and as you mentioned, the var keyword is strongly typed. It cannot be system.object. It is always strongly typed to what it infers right at declaration. So, and that's inherently different than dynamic, which we're saying, look, we don't know what this thing is, whereas in Visual Studio, you have IntelliSense for var. Now, you can, you know, pass things in. You can have a method parameter where you have dynamic as a method parameter. In fact, I'm going to show that in my next example, which, of course, you can't do for var. So, var, or dynamic certainly opens up scenarios that var could never do.
So I guess what I was asking is, can you have a var and actually pass it and receive it as that now?
Yes.
Can
yes. Okay. Yeah.
Any class that inherits from dynamic object, is that serializable so that you can send it across
the wire? Good question. So the questions he's asking is, if you look at this dynamic object that I have here, he's asking, is it serializable? Not exactly. I think the way you're probably asking the question is, and correct me if I'm wrong, is the fact that I added foo.name and foo.age, can I create that, and then can I just serialize the object, and we'll have a nice little serialization format that has a name and age that corresponds exactly to what I created? And the answer is no. But what you will get is the fact that this object implements iDictionary, so you do get the serialization that comes with iDictionary, which is sort of like a name-value pair thing. So it's sort of like that, but not exactly the user-friendly format you're probably thinking with, like, having name and age. Okay, so I'm going to lift this out, and this is a simple dynamic example object. Another thing you hear about a lot of times with dynamic programming is duck typing. So I'm going to add a class here, and we'll just call it duck typing. Keep my namespace declaration there. Okay, and what you're going to see here is I have a class called person, and I have a class called company, and the person has a property called name, and the company has a property called name, but there's no common base class between these two. These are just these simple classes. So if I want to pass either of these into a method, and I know I want to work off a name property, I can't do it in the normal polymorphic way, like if they implemented a common interface or a common base class that had that property called name, I could pass the type of the abstract class or interface in a normal object-oriented polymorphic way. But I can't do that here. So this is a scenario you hear about duck typing. And how could we do that in a easy, natural C-sharp way? Well, the only way you can do it now is if I have a person with the name of Steve and a company with the name of Microsoft, and I'm passing it into a method called do something, I can type it as object, and once again, I can revert back to relying on reflection to get that property for name, then extract the value and write it out. And it works. We can certainly come in, execute that, and it works just fine, and we can do that in any version of C#. But again, it's not a user-friendly programming experience. So how can we change this code now that we have C# 4? So what I can do is I can change that parameter to be, instead of system.object, I can just use the dynamic keyword, and I'm going to comment out all three of those lines of code. Now all I'm going to do is I'm going to do item.name, and that's it. I'm just going to dot into it. I'm just going to refer to it like normal C# syntax, if it's a property, and it just gives me the same result. There's a name for the person and for the company. So again, just giving us that more user-friendly syntax. Well, let's do another example. I have this file here called customers.xml. And what you can see here, it's got some pretty typical data in here. I got first name, middle name, last name. All I did here was I went and got the AdventureWorks database, and I just dumped the customer table to an XML file, and I just did the format so all the columns were attributes. I mean, that's where I got this data. It's just AdventureWorks. So let's see how it can work with this data in a dynamic way. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to add a new class, and we're going to call it dynamic XElement. And it's going to be somewhat similar to the dynamic object I created before in that I'm inheriting from dynamic objects again. I'm once again overriding get and set member. But in the constructor, I'm taking an X element. And so I'm not wrapping a dictionary anymore. I'm wrapping an X element, that one that goes in the constructor. And every time I get or set a member, I'm just going to the attributes collection, typical linked XML method. So I'm setting the attribute value or I'm getting the attribute value. So how can we now use this class in our code? So what I'm going to do is XElement, and I'm just going to load that XML called customers.xml. I get all the elements, and I'm just going to use a little select where I say X goes to new dynamic XElement, passing that XElement into the constructor. All right. Now at this point, I'm going to just for each over it. Instead of using var, I'm going to change this to dynamic. Now all I have to do, item.firstname, put a little space in there, item.lastname. Natural C-sharp syntax, just dotting in to the property. There's all my XML. So already you're seeing examples where, you know, in reflection scenarios, I had to know all the methods in reflection in that whole API. XML, I have to know all the, what are the different APIs, XML readers and everything else. I'm trying to unify all things here with normal C-sharp API, normal C-sharp syntax. And I can just refer to this XML by dotting into it. I don't have to call the attributes collection. And this is another scenario where we were already in a dynamic scenario. You say, well, what if you made a typo on this first name or last name? Yeah, that's possible, but I was already in a dynamic scenario. If I'm using the typical XML API and invoking those methods for try get number or try set number, I have an opportunity to make a typo when I'm typing my double quoted strings. So I haven't introduced any more danger. What I have done is simplified the code and simplified, if I expose this to a developer, I've given them a way to just write it with more succinct code. But I haven't introduced any more danger than the scenario I started with. So again, it's one of those things where leverage this thing for the right scenarios and it will be beneficial. Question?
From a performance standpoint, how would that relate to just a regular reflection versus a dynamic?
Depends on the scenario. So when the question for the benefit of the live meeting as well, the question was, what are the performance implications of some of the dynamic features that we're using here? Again, it's important to examine what scenario you're in. So for example, when I'm comparing the reflection examples, well, when I was, you know, doing the duck typing and some of the reflection APIs I was replacing, the dynamic aspects I'm using, it's using reflection behind the scenes. So whether you're using straight reflection or whether it's reflection via dynamic, it's going to be very comparable because it's just both reflection. It's just that in the case of dynamic, you have a nicer syntax. Now in this case right here with the XML, still, you don't have much performance difference. Because if you think about it, if we look at this X dynamic X element method I created, I'm not relying on reflection. I'm relying on the actual XML API in my class. I'm just wrapping it in the dynamic object. So it's still using the strong typed, high performance XML methods that I could have used out of the box, but they're being wrapped in dynamic, which is providing that nicer API to just be able to dot into the properties. Now that's not to say that all dynamic scenarios might not have some hits, but most of them, if you're going from apples to apples, I started in a dynamic scenario and still, you're going to have comparable performance. If you're going from a statically typed, strongly typed C-sharp syntax to dynamic, then of course you have a performance hit because you're introducing reflection. Let's show another example. So let me move this one aside. Dynamic X element. I have this class right here called person.rb, and this is an Iron Ruby class. It's a person class, and I've got a couple of read-only properties, first name and last name. I've got a constructor where I'm passing values in for that first name and last name. I've got a custom little method here called full name, where I'm simply concatenating the first name and last name together, and they're separated with a space. And I've got a little method down here called say hello, which is just writing hello world to the console. The puts command is Iron Ruby equivalent to console write line. How can this RB file is just a text file. It's not, there's no binary that's compiled sitting somewhere in a DLL. It's just a text file. How can we interoperate with this dynamic language text file, really, in C sharp? So you heard me mention binders in the PowerPoint. This is an example where we've got the Iron Ruby runtime. I'm calling execute file, which reads that text file, person.rb. And it runs this one line of code, which is essentially invoking the Iron Ruby constructor. And I'm storing it in a person variable, which I've typed as dynamic. At this point, what I can do is I can say person.firstname, person.fullname, person.sayHello, and I can just refer to it as if it's a C-sharp object. There's Joe, the first name, Joe Blow, the last name, and say hello is hello world. So you see here, I can just dot into it. This is not some assembly reference that I'm referencing like another DLL or another assembly. It's a text file. But I'm able to just reference this object once I've got it in scope of C-sharp as if it's a C-sharp object. Let's run it one more time and hit F5. We got the breakpoint in there. We can even look at this person object in the debugger, and we can see first name and last name, Joe Blow. Now, it's got a couple other things, tainted, frozen, don't worry about that. Those are Iron Ruby specific things. But this is just to illustrate, this is the text file that's sitting there. It's not an assembly. It's not a binary. And yet, because of those binders and runtimes, I can load this up, and I can work with these things in C-sharp by using the dynamic keyword. And not only can I work with them, but the syntax I have with which to work with them is C-sharp syntax. I can just dot into it, person.firstname, person.lastname. So when you heard me mention in the PowerPoint at the beginning, dynamic programming is meant to sort of unify all things dynamic. These are the examples of what I'm talking about. It's unifying on common C-sharp syntax. So when I had this, I didn't have to know this reflection API. I could just say foo.name, foo.age. With dynamic objects, I didn't have to worry about the syntax of a dictionary and the constructs. I could just say foo.name, foo.age. When I came to XML, I didn't have to know the whole API for dealing with and manipulating with XML files. I could just say item.firstname, item.lastname. And finally, when I wanted to interoperate with Iron Ruby, I didn't have to know another API that was like invoke method or and memorize a whole new API for Iron Ruby or another common scenario where if you're in Silverlight, you want to interop with JavaScript from Silverlight, you have to know that API where you're saying invoke method or whatever those methods are called. This whole new API you got to memorize and learn. No, you don't have to. You can just use C-sharp syntax. Person.firstname. Person.fullname. So dynamic programming, number one, is meant to unify all things dynamic into a common API, common developer experience, and that experience is the C-sharp syntax you're used to. And number two, it's something you should look at for when you're already in dynamic scenarios. How can it simplify your code? How can it make your code easier to maintain? And as you can see, in none of the examples I have given has it introduced more danger into your code because we started with a dynamic scenario. I've never advocated, you have this strongly typed, statically typed block of code that's meant to be very performant. You've never once heard me advocate, oh yeah, just switch that all to dynamic. You could, and you probably still have fine performance in most cases. But that's not necessarily an appropriate use for dynamic. This kind of stuff, it is, because we're already in a dynamic scenario. Okay, questions on dynamic before I move on to the next topic? Yes?
Is that Ruby?
Okay. What happens is, this is Iron Ruby, the Ruby create runtime, and it gives you a script runtime object. And this, when I mentioned these binders, we have binders, these different frameworks. If, for example, I want to get a handle to a Python object, the Python library for Iron Python, specifically built for .NET, would give us the same API. It would be like python.createRuntime. And it would give us the script runtime class. Yes. It's not necessarily the syntax. The binders are the thing that can give you a handle to the actual runtime and scope. So in this case, it's actually got a runtime. So it'll execute this Iron Ruby code in the Iron Ruby runtime. So to think of the binder more like giving you a handle that runtime, and that's got its own execution. Okay. And let me move all these aside. Dynamic examples. Okay. So, you heard me say at the beginning of the talk that we have four buckets that we're going to cover. Dynamic, and now we're onto the second one, which is named and optional parameters. Now, named and optional parameters is a feature that VB.NET has actually had for a number of years. And when you look back at some of the history of this, with VB.NET on one side and C-sharp on the other side, those languages haven't always really lined up. Especially in the early days, C-sharp was much more fully featured than VB. And over the years, VB has added more and more features, and it's always felt like VB's playing catch-up all the time. But if you look at, in 2010, VB's basically caught up. and in terms of features. And what now what Microsoft has finally decided to do is this term that they refer to as coevolution. So what you're going to see in this version of .NET and the next version of .NET is that these language teams are going to be more on the same page. So it's not going to be, well, we think this is a good feature to add, but we don't. No, you're going to see both teams now adding the same type of features. And the name and optional parameters is simply an example of that. So that's just kind of a look forward to what you're going to see. They're going to have, that's not necessarily going to be 100% all the time, but for the most part, you're going to see coevolution as these languages evolve in the years to come. Now, named and optional parameters, each of these are distinct features in themselves. I'm going to show you each of them being used distinct. But they also, a lot of times, are used in conjunction with each other. So I'm going to show different examples of that when I jump back into Visual Studio. Starting with optional parameters, how do you make something an optional parameter in C sharp? What's the syntax for it? Well, it's pretty simple. In this case, I've assigned y equals 1 and z equals 2. That's indicating y and z are optional parameters. If you pass a value in for y, great, you can do it. If you don't pass a value in for y, then it's going to have the value of 1 because I've set that as the default value. I've set 2 as the default value for z. Now, with named parameters, it's the syntax where you can specify the parameter name followed by a colon. So here you can see I'm calling z is equal to 25. And in fact, what I'm doing here is I'm using named and optional parameters together on this slide because 21 is the first one, which is x, and then I'm essentially skipping over y, so that's going to have a value of 1. And then I'm assigning a value of 25 to z. Okay? And also the ones that are not optional, required, have to come before on any optional parameter. So I couldn't put x at the end because that's required, so that has to go before all the optional parameters. I'm also going to show an example that talks about overload resolution as well. Now, one thing to keep in mind about named parameters is named parameters, if used appropriately, can help your code. How many times have you opened a block of code that maybe you wrote, maybe someone else wrote, and it's calling some method, and you can see some parameters being sent to that method, like true, false, true, true, false. So you have no idea what that's supposed to do. So that's a perfect example of when you can use named parameters to make that code more readable. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean you should use named parameters for every method. If you're passing a person object to a method, it might be a little redundant, and your variable is already called person. It might be a little redundant to say person colon persons. That's probably adding some clutter and some noise to your code. But for those other cases, like true, false, true, true, definitely consider how named parameters can potentially make your code a little more elegant.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
So say some method was overloaded where you only had two arguments, and then you use some method down here.
Let's revisit that question when I get into Visual Studio, because I'm actually going to show an example of overload resolution.
Okay.
So, and when I get to that, if your question is answered, great. If it's not, let's do it in the context of what I'm going to show, because that is, overload resolution is an important thing to understand as it relates to these topics. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to add a little method here called do something. And it's going to take an integer called num, and that's required, and a string called message, which is optional, the default's hello, and value called is true, and that the default is false, and I just have a console message that writes out each one. So just a baseline, let's get a normal call, do something, we'll pass in 21, ABC, and true, no quotes, true. And of course, we know 21, ABC, and true, we've passed those values explicitly into the method. Now, the other thing we can do is let's use optional parameters. So in this case, what I can do is just pass 21 and nothing else. And what we're going to see the result is that instead of ABC, we're going to get hello, because that's the default. Instead of true, which I passed in the last time, we're going to get false, because false was the default. Now, I can also use named and optional parameters together. Named and optional together. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to call num 21 message. And you see it even shows up in IntelliSense right there. I have is true, and I get that colon syntax, and I can say true. So I'm using named and optional parameters. Actually, no, this is just named parameters. So let's take out that comment, named parameters. It does what we expect it to do. It's identical to the first one. I just added named parameters. On the next example, let's use them in conjunction, named and optional parameters together. And what I'm going to do here is I'm going to use num is 21, and then I'm going to use is true, and that's true. So in effect, I'm skipping over message. I'm just using that as an optional parameter, and it's exactly what we think. The message is simply hello. Now another thing you can do is you... I don't have to. The question was, why am I providing the name for the num1? And that is purely optional. I could do this, and it's absolutely equivalent. It's just understanding the compiler lets you do it or not. It's your choice whether you use the name parameter.
So just anything after the first variable, you have to do it because it's not worth plugging
in. Exactly, exactly. Now, one thing when it does come to potentially using a name parameter to default, another thing you can do is rearrange the order. So I can come in here, and I can do the last parameter, which is the third one. It is true. I can put that first, and the first parameter, I can put that as second, and which is last, and I can forget the other one, and it's essentially equivalent to what I did before, and that works, and those two, the last two give us the exact identical results. Now, I'm just letting you know you can do that. I'm not necessarily advocating. You know, Michelotti says, yeah, just go and just do all these arbitrary orders you want. No. I'm not saying that's a good idea. I'm just simply giving you the compiler rules, what the compiler will and will not allow. Now, another thing to look at is how do we handle overload resolution? So, in fact, I'm going to comment these out just for the sake of clarity. I don't want any of this cluttering anything. Overload resolution. Let's say I have another method here called do something. And let's say it also has a parameter called num, but it's typed as an object. And what I'm going to do is I'm just going to write out in second overload, and we'll just say num. Now, if I call something like this, and we'll just say num, 21, there's a couple of rules that the compiler goes through in order to determine which one of these to call. So I call num 21. It qualifies for both of these, because I can pass 21 as an object or as an int. So the first rule the compiler looks at is it's going to look for the most strongly typed one first. So in this case, this is an N32, that's a system.object, so it's going to look for that first one first. Let's prove that to ourselves. And sure enough, we see that message that we've been seeing for that first overload. Now what happens if we change this to also be int? So in this case, they both qualify for that first rule equally. They're both strongly typed to N32. In this case, what the compiler will do is say, I'm going to look for the narrowest match. So I'm not going to make any assumptions that you're intending to do the one with the optional parameters. I'm just going to do with the bare bones. This is the narrowest match. And when I run the code again, you'll see I get the message saying, I'm in the second overload. So it's something to be aware of. Additionally, kind of an interesting thing is if I change this name here to num2, it's almost as if I can override that rule, because since I specified a named parameter in that call as num, the compiler is smart enough to, you see, I went to that one right there, because the compiler was smart enough to see, well, you use a named parameter called num. Now, if I didn't use a named parameter, we'd be back to, the second overload. Yes?
I just wrote that to take on the definition.
It went to this one, which is correct. You're saying change num2 back, right? So Visual Studio is just as smart as a C-sharp compiler. Okay. Now, the other thing I want to show is I'm going to, let me comment this one out. And actually, let me comment this out, too. I don't want to deal with overload resolution anymore. I want to talk about one other thing when it comes to optional parameters. So I'm using this one optional parameters here that we used in the beginning, and I only have this one choice, do something. And, of course, when we run it, we get the result we expect, which is hello, and is false are the methods that have the optional parameters. But I want to look at something that's going on behind the scenes. So I'm going to open this in Windows Explorer, and I'm going to open our exe here in Reflector, because what you're going to see is that when I go to that call where I'm invoking that in my main method there, what you're going to see is I'm passing 21, which is correct, but then the hello and the false, which are the default values, those are actually embedded into the call site. And that's important information to know. Let's say you had another assembly that you were creating,
and you had some methods in there that were using optional parameters, and you gave someone that assembly, and they wrote some code on that, and you have default values in there. Let's say you then go and change the default values in your assembly, and you give that new assembly to that person, and they just drop it in, and they don't recompile against that. The old default values in your old assembly are still compiled into their DLL, and so they're going to have the wrong default values that are compiled into their DLL. Now, that's an edge case. 90% of the cases you're fine, no one in here should panic. Most of the ways we deploy to production, you have a single Visual Studio solution. That Visual Studio solution references the third-party DLLs. You build it on your build server, you deploy it, it's fine. It's not an issue in 90-plus percent of the cases. But it is something to be aware of. If you are developing an application that you have a deployment model where you can just drop a supporting DLL on the fly in production, then there's something, and you don't recompile your application before, and there may be some odd cases where that's the case, then it is something to be aware of. But it's no different than constants. Constants in C# 1 is the exact same thing. When you declare a public constant in another assembly, that gets injected all where, everywhere in your assembly. So it's the exact same type of thing we've been dealing with in the C# 1. You have a public constant, that's going to get injected to the call site everywhere, and they would have to recompile against that as well. So again, nothing to panic, simply something to be aware of. Okay, so let me bring these back, and I'll move this code aside. Any questions before I move on to our third topic? No, those are the rules, yeah. Okay. I'll move that aside. So we're done with two of the buckets. We talked about dynamic. We talked about named and optional parameters. We're now on to number three out of four, which is the COM specific interop features. This is a good example where if you don't do any serious Microsoft Word or Excel programming, that kind of thing, this is not going to be a life-changing feature for you as a developer. But it's good to know the features that they've added. There's a couple things as it relates to COM objects. We have automatic objects to dynamic mapping, and I'll show an example of what I mean by that. Of course, now we have optional and named parameters, which I just showed, and that was one of the pain points that C# developers had when trying to deal with Word and Excel before, and which is one of the things that in many cases just caused us to just punt to go to VB, because VB already did have named and optional parameters. Ref is optional for COM programming. Ref is not optional for normal C#. You still need to use it for normal C#. But in places where you had to pass it before, you don't have to anymore. And finally, we have this concept called NOPIA, P-I-A. The primary interop assembly was a pain point we previously had where you had to lug around this like 12 meg DLL that had all the interop types and worry about, well, am I deploying it to the GAC? Now those types are simply injected into your assembly, so your deployment concerns can now go away. And I'm going to actually show an example of what I mean by that to make that a little bit more clear. So let's go to the demo. I'm going to add a class, and we'll just call it COMInterop. And this is using Excel, and it's code that would have been what we would have used in the last version of C#. So I'm just grabbing that same customers.xml file that I showed you in the previous example when I was using dynamic against XML. I'm just using a simple little link to XML query where I say, look at the last name, specifically look at the first letter of the last name, and do a little group by over it so I can get the count. Think of it like a dictionary. I'm saying, show me all the people whose last name starts with A, let me see the number. All the people whose last name starts with B, let me see the number. C, the number. D, the number. So it's just the count of each letter. And then I'm creating an Excel workbook when I just display a simple table that's got the headings, letter, and number, and I'm just looping over the results and just outputting those results in a simple table. And then finally I'm invoking the chart wizard, and I'm just displaying those in a chart. And you can see already we've got some ugliness here with the type.missing. It's not a lot of fun to write, but it works. You can do it. So we could say com interop example. We execute. We read the XML file, you can see the chart displays, and then we just invoke that two lines of code to the chart, or one line of code to the chart wizard, and we can say letter B is the winner. There's 114 people in that XML file whose last name starts with B. So how can we change this code?
to make it a little bit more friendly from a developer perspective. Well, the first thing is we have optional parameters. So right off the bat, I can remove that type.missing. Additionally, we have automatic objects of dynamic mapping. So I don't have to do all this casting. I can refer directly to it. So I'm just simply going to remove the cast. So I'm going to hold down the Alt key, and you can see I just did a block select. So I selected two lines at once, a block select, by holding down the Alt key. That feature was always actually in Visual Studio. The new feature we have in Visual Studio now that adds to block select is block edit. So I can now just delete that. In fact, I can even come in here and say, hello world. Hi, everybody. And now we have block edit as well as block select by holding down that Alt key. So I come in here, remove the parentheses, and you can see when I mouse hover over value, it says dynamic expression is going to be resolved at runtime. But the syntax is much nicer. I can just refer to the cells and the value. Same thing here. I'm going to do a block edit by removing the casts. My code has already becoming less noisy. Then when I get down here, what you're going to see is, and I can remove this cast as well as remove this cast. What you're going to see is I have type.missing. I'm using ActiveSheet as the second parameter, which happens to have a name of after, which I can see in IntelliSense there. So I'm just going to delete that first argument there. I'm going to delete this, bring this in, and then that's going to be it. I don't want these type.missings anymore, so I'm going to use named and optional parameters together such that that line is much more readable now. And then the chart wizard, this is the bear where I've type.missing, about 8 type.missings. I'm using the first parameter and then like the 7th or 8th parameter for customer's last name, which is the title. So once again, I can use title, which is a named parameter, and I can come in and delete everything up to that right here. And I can delete everything after that, all those type.missings. And just for good measure, let's get rid of that last one. So now when we look at the code, after my link to XML query, it just starts right here on line 22, and I've got some white space and some curly braces in here. But when we look at this code now, it's only about 15 lines of code. It's much simpler to look at. It's much more pleasing to the eyes, much more pleasing to write as a developer. But the functionality is the same. It still spins up our chart, writes the values to the table, and then invokes the chart wizard. So if you are someone that's had to do some C# programming against Common Interop before, I think you'll have a much nicer time doing it now as compared to what you did previously. Now, one other thing I want to show, you heard me mention the NoPia. I'm going to come back here to Reflector, and I'm just going to hit the refresh. And now what you're going to see is I have this namespace, Microsoft Office Interop Excel. That's now embedded into my assembly. I wasn't there before. It injected those primary interop types into my assembly. In addition to that, it was even smart enough to only inject the types that I needed. So, for example, you don't see any references to Microsoft Word in here, but you see the types I needed. So, for example, you see I've got some reference to the chart events. If I were to comment out the lines that I used to invoke the chart wizard, you wouldn't see these chart objects in here. It only injects the types that it needs. So it keeps it much more lean and mean, much nicer deployment story than what we had in previous versions. You hear someone say NoPia, that's all they mean, the types being injected. Questions on Com Interop before I move to the next and last? Which line are you looking at? Right here?
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is, You might hear some people refer to this as peter out typing. That's how Microsoft refers to it sometimes. And what that means is it starts out as strongly typed. So, for example, I'm using it as a var. So I have XL right here. And if you look at my IntelliSense, I have IntelliSense at this point. I have workbooks right here, right there. But then, and even in this case, I have strongly typed methods. But for example, this cells right here, this value, see how the value is a dynamic expression? So I actually don't have that in IntelliSense. So I could have declared this as dynamic if I wanted to, but I didn't have to. I can start out as strongly typed. And what you're going to see is there are certain methods or properties that hang off of, in this case, the Excel, which I've got highlighted in yellow everywhere. There are certain ones that are strongly typed, like the workbooks, and even the cells, but the further we go down the chain, this is an area where it had problems resolving some of those, and you saw me referring to casts previously. Now I don't have to, because the framework itself will just automatically resolve those things that were the system.object before, where I had to have that cast in there. Anything that's system.object now, C# will automatically say, hey, just use dynamic. So before, the first version of the code had casts in here,
and now I was able to remove the casts.
Right, it's the value that's dynamic, not the XML.
Correct, correct. Yep, you got it. Okay.
Any other questions on comment or op? Yes. No. The question was, does it work in C Sharp 3.0? Only C Sharp 4.0, because it's using those features in C Sharp 4.0, like optional parameters and name parameters. Correct, correct. Yes. Yeah, the question is, does C Sharp 4.0 come with 2010? The answer is yes. Okay. So, we've done number one, dynamic. Number two, named and optional parameters. Number three, com interop. Now we're on to number four, and the final new feature of C#, which is variants. Now, I'm going to describe variants in a decent amount of detail here, but I want to start out it by caveating it, saying it's just not a feature you're going to find yourself using very often in your daily lives as a C# developer. It's not something you're going to notice that much. It's not something you're going to need to know about that much. Now, we're still going to learn about it and talk about it and understand it, but again, it's not a life-changing feature. Variance is one of those things that you tend to notice it when it's not there. Because in previous versions of C#, you would sometimes run into situations where the compiler wouldn't compile a piece of code for you, and you'd say, scratch your head, why doesn't this compile? This should. And now those scenarios just will. They just will compile. And I'm going to show some of those exact scenarios. Now, when we talk about covariance and contravariance, you know, they sound like complicated words, so let me demystify that right from the beginning. Covariance is when we pass in a more derived type. So in this case, I have a method called doSomething, which is declared a system.object. Here I'm calling it passing in a string. A string is a more derived type than system.object. I'm passing it in. That's covariance. That's it. Contravariance, I can assign a less derived type. So I have this method here called getStringMessage, which returns a string, and I can assign it to system.object, which is less derived than a string. Now, if you're looking at that and saying, well, that's just OO, well, then you're right. That's it. So contravariance and covariance, any object-oriented language, Java, C#, VB, whatever, that's covariance and contravariance. So don't worry about what those terms mean. It's as simple as that. It's not more complicated than that. Covariance, passing a more derived type in. Contravariance, taking a derived type and assigning it to a less derived type coming out. All right? Now, within .NET, collections are of course the number one thing that people typically talk about with covariance and contravariance, because in previous versions of .NET, collections were basically invariants. You could treat them covariantly, safely covariantly sometimes, but not all the time. I'm going to show an example of what I mean by that. Additionally, you have methods that look like this, where if I had a method declared with IEnumerable of object, and if I had attempted to pass an IEnumerable string into that method, the compiler would say, no, I am not going to allow that, because I can't convert from IEnumerable to string. That's IEnumerable string, not IEnumerable object. And you'd be sitting there yelling at the compiler, why can't I do that? Of course I can treat a string as an object. I'm just writing it out to the console. Now, if you were frustrated by that, you were right to be frustrated by that. And now C#4.0, that will simply just work. I'm going to show you an example of why that is. So how does this work? We have a couple of new contextual keywords called in and out. Contextual being the key word there, because most of the keywords in C# are contextual. They mean different things depending on where they are. I mean, we already have an in keyword in C#. It's for each something in your collection. We already have an out keyword. It's, you know, out parameters on a method. But it's contextual. If it sees these keywords in the angle brackets, it knows, oh, I'm dealing with covariance and contravariance here. So with variants in .NET 4, you can apply these keywords to generic interfaces or delegates, and that's it. Those are the rules, generic interfaces or delegates. And when we say something, when we give something an out parameter, that's output safe. That means it's safely covariant. And what you're going to see is a lot of the fundamental interfaces that are in the base class library of .NET have now been changed in 4.0 to include. So IEnumerable, perfect example. You can't get to be a more fundamental interface than that in the .NET framework. That's the definition has now changed in .NET 4 to give it the out keyword to say this is safely covariant. Conversely, we have input safe, safely contravariant. We have the in keyword, so we have the iComparable interface now has the in keyword.
I'm going to show examples of these when I jump back to Visual Studio. As I mentioned, just a couple of rules here. You can only apply to interfaces and delegates. A reference conversion must exist. This is important. It has to be a reference type, not a value type. So you can't, if you're dealing with like a list of integers, the rules don't apply when you're doing conversions between the two. So an inheritance relationship must exist. Ref and out parameters, they need an invariant type. All right, so let's get into the final demo here.
So I'm going to add a class called variants. And let me just execute this real quick here. And my execute method. And what you're going to see here is I just have a list of objects. I've just got 1 through 10, and I'm for reaching over it. And I'm sending this method into this list into a method called printSum. And I'm simply just for reaching over the method and summing it all up. So if I run it, I'm simply going to get 1 through 10, and the sum of the numbers between 1 through 10 is 55. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to copy these lines of code right here, and I'm going to add a method here called safe covariance. And I'm going to pass this method in, pass the list into this new method called safe covariance, and then once again, I want to output the items from the list and print the sum. And this is how I could treat something in previous versions of .NET as safely covariant. So I'm looping over the list, and I'm essentially incrementing the index of each one. I'm swapping the positions. So you see I'm adding I plus 1 to the position. I'm just shifting the items around. So if we run it, what you're going to see is that the first item in the list is no longer 1. It's now 2. And the last item in the list is no longer 10. It's 1. So I've shifted everything up once in the array. Of course, the sum is still 55 because we're dealing with the same numbers. So I've treated this as safely covariant. I can do this in any version of .NET, essentially. Now, the next thing is I can also treat things as not safely covariant. So if I come in here and pass this method, this list to unsafe variants, what you see this does is when I compile, it compiles just fine. Compiler's got no beef with this code. But what if you actually look at what's happening, I'm calling a toString on it. Well, the compiler says, hey, this is a list of objects. I can put a string on that, no problem. I have no problem doing it. That compiles just fine, but when we actually go to run it, specified cast is not valid. You know, it was thinking it was an integer, and that's bad news there. So these are just some potential things you can run into. Now, in terms of some of the examples that I discussed previously, I had this example on the PowerPoint where I was outputting a list. So I'm just going to create a new list here. We'll just call it list of strings. New list of strings. And I'm just going to put A, B, C in there. And I'm just going to send this to the output list method. Now, what you see here is that in previous versions of C#, writing the method like this was really the only option I had available to me. That is, making the method itself a generic method was the only choice I had. And of course, it still runs right. I can come in here and there's my ABC at the top. But the only choice I had, if I wanted to actually write a method that could be used for different generic types, I had to make the method itself generic. In C# 4, I'm no longer constrained to that. I don't need to make the method generic anymore, so I can take that type constraint out. I can now say IEnumerable of objects. This is the exact scenario where, as in previous versions of C#, if I just try to compile it, right off the bat, boom, the compiler would say, nope, I don't know how to convert that. And now you can see my build succeeded. Compiler, it just works now. And when I run it, it says, sure, no problem. There's ABC. Of course I can treat a string like an object. Now, How does it pull that off? If we look at the definition of IEnumerable here, I'm just going to F12 on it, you can see that IEnumerable now has this out keyword that's been actually added to the interface. And you can even look at the Visual Studio documentation here. It says the object's parameter is covariant. That is, you can use a type you specified or any type that is more derived. We talked about that more derived on the PowerPoint. And if you see here, when we talk about out, it's output safe. If we look at the methods on this, the return value, that generic type parameter, is a return value, meaning it's going out. Contrast that with, let me just put in iComparable here, of string. If I look at the definition of iComparable, now iComparable has the in keyword to it. Once again, if we look at the documentation right here, the type parameter is contravariant. That is, you can use a type, you can either a type that's specified or a type that is less derived. And if you look at the definition of iComparable, the type parameter is no longer a return value like the way it was in iEnumerable. It's the input.
So iEnumerable, that was a return value. It was going out. Just think of it, the out direction. iComparable is going in. The type parameter is going in. It's input safe. Where's the other one? Output safe.
So let's do one final example here. And what I'm going to do is, let me delete this. I'm going to add one more class called Animal. Bring that back. And I simply have a class called Animal, and then I have a dog that inherits from Animal, and I have a cat that inherits from Animal. Simple inheritance relationship there. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to add a couple of delegates. Let me get this out of the way so that doesn't distract us. I have an Animal action and an Animal func. So what I can do here is I can say Animal action of Animal. We'll just call it Animal action. And we'll just give it, we'll say A for Animal. A goes to, let's give it a little lambda, console write line of A. And now if I have Animal action of cat, call it cat action, if I try to assign that Animal action to it, if I try to build, the compiler says no, 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 and if we look at the problem, it says I cannot implicitly type from Animal action of Animal to Animal action of cat. But if we come in here to the definition of Animal action, and we add the in keyword to it, now the compiler is perfectly happy. By the similar token, if we come in here and I use the animal func, and we say animal func of cat, cat func, and we'll just use a little lambda saying new cat, and animal func animal, and we try to assign the cat func to it. Once again, compiler says no, 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 you can't do that. We come in here, I think you can predict what I'm going to do. I use the out parameter, the out keyword, I mean, and the build succeeded. So we said that's covariant. It's the in keyword, it's input safe, it's safely contravariant. The out keyword is safely covariant. So it's good to know what those mean. It's good to know, you know, what is doing behind the scenes. But again, it's not something that you're going to be writing code, and oh, where's the out go, and where's the in go? It's rare. It's usually something you notice when it's not there. Question?
Is it something that you probably want most of the time to put in your code? I mean, because you don't know in the future how they're going to be using it. So it seems like if you're writing a response that you did, you probably want it by default, right?
Yeah, so the question is it something you would just kind of want most of the time and therefore put in default? I don't know if I can really give a good answer to that. I mean, the thing that Microsoft has done is they have put those keywords on their fundamental interfaces. So yeah, depending on what your class is doing, I can see the case for putting it in there kind of out of the gate. So yeah, it's an interesting question. I hadn't really thought about it like that. But yeah, it certainly doesn't necessarily hurt to put them in there, in other words. I'm sorry?
Because if they have habits to get into, that will allow you to like do that.
Well, not necessarily. It depends on the case. If we just want to support the normal OO case where it's okay to pass a more derived type in, that's safe. That's why they were missing on the iEnumerable interfaces previously.
It seems like that almost is really just a
bad fix. Yeah, that's the default. That's essentially how Microsoft has described it with some of the base class interfaces. It's more of a fix because you couldn't do it before. Other questions? Okay. A couple additional resources if you download these slides. Definitely the white paper. It's only about 25 pages. A professional C-sharp developer is 20 minutes well worth your time to understand these features, really learn them for your jobs. Remember to fill out an evaluation. And to download the code, there's a link to my blog right here, geekswithblogs.net/Michelotti. And in the next 24 hours, I'll make sure the PowerPoint and all the code that I did in this demo is, you can just download it from there. And that's it. If you have additional questions, you can grab me afterwards. So, thanks a lot.
One final question. I have a book to give away. Okay? So the question is, what is the interface in .NET that makes all dynamic programming possible? You got it.
Thank you.